Welcome to the first of a new series on WIDELP, our Freethinkers Hour. Our guest today is John Loftus, who attended the first 2 days of the Freethought Festival 2012 on the University of Wisconsin campus. John, do you have some responses to what you heard yesterday and today?
Well, yeah. First, Robert, I want to just thank you for taking some time out to interview me. Appreciate that. And I want to say that this Freethought Festival is a model of what a Freethought Festival should be like. I understand Chris Calvi got together most of these speakers, or all of them, and I think he did an outstanding job with the topics and the diversity of speakers and the enthusiasm the speakers have with regard to each one of their topics. I learned a lot. I enjoyed meeting these speakers and the people that were there. I just, like I said, I think it's a model for other Freethought festivals, just with the caliber of people that they had here, and I'm excited to be a participant.
Yeah, it's certainly been an ambitious project, a 3 day festival with 21 speakers.
Yes, and you know, there's some, I'll have to say, and I'll probably be linking to some of the talks on my blog as I get links to them, including this interview, so thanks again for that. But I really think that Richard Carrier had an outstanding presentation about the historicity of Jesus, and those of you know, I think that there was a historical founder to the Jesus cult that became mythologized. I'm going to say that again. You can edit this out. Mythologized. And I think that it would be something I could endorse, because he's going to present it as a Bayesian hypothesis with a certain amount of probability to it. And I think he's just done a lot of good research for it, and I'm excited to see how it transpires, and you know, the amount of documentation that he might have for that. So I'm excited, after hearing his presentation, to entertain that thesis again. And I don't know whether I'll be convinced or not, but I think that it's probably going to be probably the best work out there that will advance the discussion. So I wanted to say that, Robert. I thought that was a really outstanding talk.
You mentioned your blog. Is this the sort of topic you discussed on your blog?
Sometimes. I seem to get in trouble when I do. I get shot at from both sides.
What's the name of your blog?
Well, if you Google it, you can just Google Debunking Christianity. You can use that one word or with a space between it. You'll find me, even though I think there's a Christian site out there that has taken up the debunkingchristianity.com domain. But somehow that gets lost, and it's probably on page 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8 by now. Just Debunking Christianity, you'll find me.
Uh-huh. And how long have you been doing this blog?
6 years. Probably about an hour or two a day, and some days when I've got nothing else to do, it's, you know, 3 or 4 hours, and sometimes it's fun and sometimes it's not. Sometimes I get bored. I feel like I'm a factory worker where I have to, like, do the same thing over and over every day, but that has to do with the arguments. Because the Christians, the new Christians will find the site, and they will initially think that somehow I'm ignorant or dumb or stupid or all three and more, and evil and wicked.
So they raise questions you've had to deal with before.
All the time. And so, you know, for the first 3 years or four, I had several bloggers on there who helped me. Valerie Tirico, who was one of the speakers, was one of the bloggers there. Uh-huh. And, you know, I had help. And then, you know, gradually over time, I just started blogging on my own. And I found that it really helps to have some good commentators like I have on my blog that can take up my lack of time or patience when it comes to some of these same arguments or these same quotes from the Bible. So they really get my hat tipped, because I couldn't deal with all of the comments that Christians give me. But a lot of them are just the same old, same old, same old, same old. And, you know, so I've written about most of the questions or comments from Christians, and so sometimes I'll just link to one of my blog posts. Mm-hmm. They'll say, well, what about this or what about that? Link. Whereas my peeps or my posse, as I call them, they will engage them for lengthy threads lasting into 200 and 300 comments, and I read them, you know, and sometimes I'll skim over them. Sorry. But they do an excellent job. And so for 6 years, I've been blogging and writing, and I've heard it all. I've basically heard it all, but I appreciate the commentators.
What led you to start this blog?
It just seemed like the thing to do. There were a blogger as a source for comments had started up a few years earlier, and I don't know actually when it started up, but more and more people were going over there and, you know, starting their own blogs. So I just decided, well, let me try it, because I didn't really want to host a website domain. Blogger's free, and you know, let's see if I can't get, you know, my message out on this you know, new domain. And so I was not one of the earliest by far, but it seemed like by now everybody's got a blog of some kind, whether it's through Blogger or WordPress. But
so which came first, the starting to write on the blog or writing books about this subject?
Yeah, well, I self-published a book. I got asked from former parishioners and colleagues, you know, why left the faith, and, you know.
You should explain to our listeners that you were once a preacher.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I was a preacher, and I have several degrees, you know, trying to understand my faith. You know, I had 3 master's degrees and PhD work, and so, you know, studied with William Lane Craig. People find that interesting. So when I walk away from the faith, people were asking me, well, why? You know, that's the very first thing. Why? Well, of course they want to know. And so I kind of got tired of telling everybody the same story over and again. So I said, well, let me just sink some money into this self-published book, put it on the local bookshelf of a local bookstore, and, you know, somebody wants to find out, you know, there it is. And, excuse me. And I did that, and, you know, of course, it also went on Amazon, and Ed Babinski found it and read it and or heard of me, and he said, you know, tell me more. And he and I struck up a real good friendship, and he sort of introduced me to the Skeptical Society at large, just by encouraging me and stuff. And so then, you know, I just got pretty passionate about blogging and writing and discussing on forums, which was where I first went. And, you know, I revised the book again, and then I got it published through Prometheus, and then I just
How did that Prometheus publication come about?
Well, I sent my self-published book to Paul Kurtz, and I said, you know, what do you think of it? Do you think it's worthy of publication? You know, I'm thinking about getting it published, and I suggested a publisher, you know, and he said, well, after a day or so, he read it, and he said, well, I'm willing to recommend it to Prometheus Books. And so I, you know, thought about it. I said, sure. Prometheus is the premier atheist publisher of our generation, and perhaps of any generation. So it's all, I'm proud to be a Prometheus author. And I was pretty thankful that that he did so, and then that they published it. And then, of course, just recently, it's been about a month now, the second edition of Why I Became an Atheist came out, you know, and is now available. And very rarely does an atheist book make it into a second edition.
And this is an expanded version?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's somebody who has read both the first edition, the first Prometheus Books edition, and this one, I have said that, you know, it's as much as 50% better. And, you know, it has 100 extra pages, and the documentation has been brought up to date, you know, even though it's only been a few years. And I think I've gotten some better arguments along the way as I've been blogging. I learn from the bloggers. They mm-hmm. teach me both on both sides. Mm-hmm. And it's a much better book. Even though right now as we sit here, I can think of better ways to say it. Because I rewrote it, I rewrote the second edition about a year ago. So even now, after a year, I can think of some better things that should have been said, you know. But then I'm going to put a cork on it. I'm done with it. That book's done. I'm not going to revisit it, even though I could probably think of a few better ways to express myself. But I like the result, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You also do some editing of books with other contributors?
Who told you?
Well, I got this book from the library called The Christian Delusion. Isn't that the title?
Yes, The Christian Delusion. Yep. That came about as I was blogging, and, you know, some scholars and I got together and saw eye to eye on certain things, and I put together, I think it's, 14 chapters there, or 15 of some really good... good arguments, and, you know, I'm really proud of that book. I'm really happy to be involved. I've written 4 chapters for it myself.
You've got Robert Price and yes. Richard Carrier.
Yes. Hector Avalos, wonderful man, excellent mm-hmm. scholar. I mean, everybody is an expert in their field. David Eller, a cultural anthropologist, he argues in the very first chapter that the reason why we aren't as successful at arguing Christians away from their faith is simply because they were never argued into it in the first place. I just found that chapter to be amazing, because how they usually adopt their faith is because they were raised in a certain culture. And, you know, in America, you know, largely but not entirely, it's a Christian culture. We use Christian names for streets and cities and people, you know, baby boys and girls, and you know, some of our documents, you know, in which is something we need to fight, have Christian laws written to them, and so Christians weren't, and that's, we're trying to fight those out of there, but Christians were never argued into their faith in the first place. No wonder we can't argue them out very easily, although eventually, if they pay attention, it can and does happen. Yeah.
So that's the problem, getting their attention.
Oh, yeah.
And your blog does that, though.
Yeah, it's called Debunking Christianity. I mean,
people wonder, what's this about? And
oh, yeah, yeah.
They come to defend their...
faith. You know, it sounds to most Christians pretty offensive. And it also sounds like somebody doesn't know what they're talking about. Somebody, you can't debunk Christianity. Christianity's been around for 2,000 plus years. So usually their initial comment is treating me like I'm a bumpkin. Really, you know, I just love that, because as soon as they do it, it's not very long before they realize that is not the case. I mean, I've got some pretty solid scholarship behind me and mm-hmm. some education, and I certainly know what I'm talking about. It's not long, if they want to stay there, where they realize, oh, in a way that they're outgunned, most of them, you know, and I would think all of them, simply because even the best educated of them are wrong. I mean, you know, they get, you know, they see Debunking Christianity, they think, okay, well, let's just go in and have some fun and just show these, you know, bumpkins, you know, the truth. And some of them quote Bible to me and stuff mm-hmm. like that. But yeah, it gets their attention. But they find that I'm, by and large, polite and respectful of their religion, of their faith. Unless it's the same guy over and over and over and over again, then I can be pretty irate. You know, I can probably say, or like I said, I've got some good people who comment that take them on and are patient where my patience leaves off.
How did all these contributors come to be part of your book, The Christian Delusion?
Well, I just asked them.
These are people you wanted in there, and...
Yeah, I knew of them, and I had read their works and had recommended them, or they had read my previous book, Why I Became an Atheist, and they liked what they saw, and a couple of them were bloggers, like Ed Babinski, who has a really nice chapter on the cosmology of the Bible. He and I were blogging together, and Jason Long was another one who wrote a chapter on the malleability of the human mind. See, the human mind is really malleable. I mean, you know, sometimes it depends on who gets to you first. And, you know, we tend to justify our conclusions on hindsight. You know, and we don't seek out balanced opinion. We seek out that which confirms what we want to believe. Mm-hmm. And so I had Jason Long write that chapter. Valerie Tirico wrote one on cognitive science. You know, just an excellent chapter about, you know, some of the things she talks about is agency detecting that we were, you know, we have inherited through evolution our predecessors' propensity to see agents and faces behind random events. And so then from out of that, you know, it's easy to create religion because when thunder comes down from the sky, we think there must be a Zeus up there or some angry god that lives up there. And so, you know, it certainly goes a long way towards explaining, you know, how religion originated. So, you know, yeah, it's a great book. And Hector Avalos has a wonderful chapter on Hitler, arguing that Hitler was actually an advocate of something called positive Christianity. I mean, you know, it's something similar to the KKK today, if you actually take a look at it. Indianapolis had one of the biggest numbers of the KKK in the last century, in the middle of the last century. They were Christians. I mean, they got the people elected into office.
Yeah, they'd burn a cross.
But they'd burn a cross, and certainly racist, ugly racist that they were. But Hector Avalos doesn't necessarily connect it with the KKK that I remember. It's just that Hitler had a view like that. You know, it was called positive Christianity, and it makes a wonderful argument for that. Don't be throwing Hitler in my face anymore, you know, that, well, Hitler was an atheist. Not after you read Hector Avalos' chapter. He just utterly destroys that. And Richard Carrier has a wonderful chapter in there on Christianity was not the cause of modern science. And, you know, Christians will throw that in my face, too. Well, you know, what about Isaac Newton and Boyle and Galileo and others, you know, and he just utterly destroys that. I mean, science had arisen in the Hellenistic world prior to Christianity, and he just documents that and that absolutely utterly destroys that. So there's several chapters in there that, you know, taken together, I think they really point out, you know, how delusional the Christian faith is. You know? One of my highlights is the outsider test for faith, you know, that I've been known for arguing.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked at any other religions?
When I was a Christian, I had looked at a lot of different religions. here's a strange thing about that. You know, I studied, you know, a little bit of Hinduism and Buddhism. I taught Buddhism in my philosophy classes, you know, at least partially. I wasn't a Buddhist.
What school was that you taught that on?
Well, I taught for Keller Community College. I taught for Tri-State University. I taught for Grace Lake College in near Deerfield. Grace Lake, Illinois, yeah. And, I would teach philosophy classes, logic classes, ethics classes. I've studied these other religions mostly as a Christian, you know. And I've studied the cults, Jehovah's Witnesses, that's what they call them, the cults. But to me, they're all Christian, you know. You know, it's interesting on your blog, you'll say something that's supposed to be against Christianity. And inevitably, someone comes up and says, well, that's not true Christianity. You know, the no true Scotsman's fallacy. And some of your listeners will know of that. I've studied those other religions. The fascinating thing, I mean, not all of them, there's so many to study. But the fascinating thing about it is that I rejected them all. I mean, I rejected the only one I didn't reject was my version, my evangelical, my fundamentalist Christianity. I mean, I reject them, and I don't know that I can come up with all the reasons why I rejected these other religions at this point today now. But I rejected them all for what I considered good enough reasons that they still hold. The only thing I didn't do is reject my own religion. So here's what happened. Once I rejected my own religion, having already rejected the other religions, I became an agnostic and then later an atheist. I mean, did you revisit some of those things? Well, I did. I actually went through different stages, and it was a 12-year process because people, like Valerie Tirico said today in one of her talks, that it depends on, you know, how ingrained you were and, you know, what it means to you, how long it takes you to leave the faith, and or what causes it to bring your own demise.
She said it took a long time for her.
Yeah, it took me 12 years. And I went through various stages, being an evangelical Christian. I became moderate, and I became a liberal, and then I became a deist. What I called myself was a deistic existentialist. I choose to believe. And those of your listeners would know what existentialism is. I mean, there's really no basis for, you know, which is just faith. You know, I believe that there must be an afterlife, and that God is the source of, you know, consciousness, and that God is the source of morality. You know, that's, you know, just, you know, existentialism. And then I became an agnostic, and then I became an atheist. It took 12 years for that process. I think the first 6 years it took me 6 years to become an agnostic, and then I just basically walked away from it. I mean, there was a 6-year period where I didn't even think about it much. I just got on with my life. And then when I came up to thinking anew, then is when I adopted this. Hey, I said this. If nothing else, if there is a God that does exist, and being the agnostic that I was, if there is a God that exists, then I can safely ignore him. you know, the agnostics and the atheists, they're much more in the same camp than the agnostics or atheists will realize. It depends, and it does depend on how you define agnosticism, because I know there's the Huxleyan version and there's Bertrand Russell's version, and I write about that on my blog. Any kind of God at all, at that point, can be safely ignored, because you're not dealing with the fundamentalist God who's going to, you know, send you to hell at that point anyway. It's a loving type of nebulous God out there. Well, you can safely ignore that. I'm an atheist, just like that.
You have any more thoughts on the conference and motivating you to become more of an activist?
Well, I liked... there's a contrast between two of the speakers. I mean, they're all good. If I don't mention somebody, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, they're all good. I was fascinated by Veronica Drance's talk on the LGBTI people, especially the intersex people, and how doctors have decided to cut off genitalia because they've decided your sex, and I mean, tried to have you be raised as a girl in a man's body because you didn't allow the boy to grow up to a man to decide for himself. I thought that was fascinating stuff. I hope that goes viral, her talk, is what I'm saying. But I found it interesting, and Kevin Padian's talk about the Dover trial, he is hilarious. If I could just be as funny as him, I think I could get an audience. But I found a contrast between Elliot Sober and J.T. Eberhard that I found interesting, very interesting. Sober is a philosopher.
And he loves to philosophize.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, I mean, you know, everything's carefully mapped out. And he's trying to make a case, you know, and you kind of wonder what... I didn't have any problems following it. It'd be very good. But he was in teaching mode about evidentialism. And those of you who can get online and get the video when it finally comes up, he was in a teaching mode. He was trying to provoke questions. And I thought to myself while he was talking, and it was an excellent talk, that he was in teacher mode. Now, Here's what philosophers do, because I've taught philosophy classes. Here's what you do. In your philosophy class, you provoke thought. Your goal in a philosophy class is provide information, enough good information, and then let the students think through it. And you become, say, the moderator, you know, like a Phil Donahue or an Oprah Winfrey. You know, you just field questions, and if the students are moving in one direction, then a good philosophy instructor will move the students in the other direction just to make them think. And that's what he was sort of doing, you know, for that talk on, it's called Some Questions for Atheists to Think About. He didn't try to solve any of them. Now contrast that with J.T. Eberhardt. I tell you, if there's one talk I enjoyed that quite. I mean, just for the sheer entertainment of it. Now I'm sure that Elliot Sober could probably, show some of the things that Eberhardt had said that was wrong, but it doesn't matter because, see, when you're talking to a free thought group, you don't have to convince them. You just don't have to convince them. And you find that, we can all rally around certain ignorances that believers have. And JT did a wonderful job of making us laugh and showing the ridiculousness of the faith position. I already mentioned Richard Carrier. Awesome job. It was nice to meet Annie Gaylor. But one last thing. They're all good. Sean Faircloth. Mm-hmm. Speaking on behalf of the Richard Dawkins Foundation.
Right.
I encourage everyone to get behind that. And I'm going to be doing some blogging on his project to try to get little groups of, first off, lots of different things. 10 points. Anyway, the 10 points, you'll have to, read and watch the videos as I link to them, the 10 points that he was stressing. But they want to get pockets of people all over America, and I suppose the world, but I think that they're focusing on America.
And they're working on state issues.
State issues, right. Exactly. So that we have lobbyists, or we have people who can write letters, or we can have people who get active, because as a former lobbyist himself, was that what he was?
Well, and he was also a legislator in the state of Maine.
Yeah, and he never heard from one secular person about any legislative issue. You know, they didn't have any lobbyists. They didn't have any people like that. And so I'm really excited about what Dawkins and Faircloth are attempting to do, and I'm going to be mentioning a lot about that. So I might be moving more into an activist mode, at least, if nothing else, promoting what Richard Dawkins and he are going to full-fledged campaign for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I enjoy it. I'm just so pumped.
Well, good. Any closing thoughts?
No, just thank you so much for your hospitality. Yeah. You and your wife, Barbara, are just wonderful people. And, there are a lot of people like yourselves that, do the grunt work. I saw you taking some pictures at the pre-thought session. Maybe you even picked up a couple of the speakers and just emailing back and forth me, sending me stuff. These are the kind of people that are the unsung heroes, and I just wanted to thank you personally for that.
And I hope to have all 21 of these speakers in successive weeks on this radio station, and thank you for being our first guest.
Thank you so much.